Welcome to Cleveland Clinic Health Talk Podcasts, featuring presentations by leading Cleveland Clinic physicians and medical experts. Today's speaker, Dr. John Lampe, presents myths and facts about pediatric vaccines.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here tonight to talk about a subject that's near and dear to my heart as a pediatrician, because as Dr. Sullivan said, it's probably the biggest health advance for keeping children healthy through a lifetime that's come about in modern medical times for sure. People sometimes joke that if you had to choose between keeping pediatricians and keeping the vaccines would be the better choice. It's made a huge impact. So we'll go through some of the things that have to do with the history of vaccines, which I think is kind of interesting because it's like a lot of things in life, everything that's old is new again, and you keep hearing some of the same things come up time and again. So looking backward, it's hard for us now to appreciate the fact that at the beginning of the 20th century, this is what mortality statistics look like. About 20% of all infants died in infancy, and of those who survived, about another 20% died before they got to the age of five. That's like early 1900s. Pretty dramatic. And it's also, I think, hard for people in modern times to remember how terrorizing the concept of infectious disease that would suddenly overtake someone in their life, in the prime of their life, often for children, and could cause their death in the matter of days in somebody who was previously healthy. I think in modern times we can think of like Ebola virus, you know, for things that people fear, or say in a year where influenza is particularly a strong version of it, and you know, you hear about children getting influenza and dying over the course of a couple of days. So we have modern examples of that, but I, you know, back in the 1950s, for example, with polio, in the early 1900s, I think in 1917, I read they had about 6,000 deaths from polio during an epidemic of polio in the United States. And even in the 1950s, so when I was a boy, there was still about 25 or 26,000 cases of polio per year in the United States. Then the polio vaccine was developed and started being used in 1955. By 1960, the number had dropped down to about 3,000 cases a year, and by 1979, one case per year in the United States. So really fantastically helpful in all of these diseases like whooping cough, diphtheria, smallpox, polio, congenital rubella infections, all were really the scourge of society and have been really mastered by the use of vaccines. The first vaccine developed was, as I'm sure you have heard, a smallpox vaccine. It was in England, and it was developed by a country physician named Edward Jenner. He made the interesting observation that milkmaids who got an illness called cowpox usually were not affected in getting smallpox when they had smallpox epidemics that would come through a town and decimate the population. And he actually had the idea and then implemented that idea of immunizing a child, this particular one, James Phipps, an 8-year-old, with the permission of his parents, obviously, with some fluid from a cowpox lesion that he had gotten from one of the milkmaids who had a cowpox infection. And then 6 weeks later, after the immunity had a chance to take hold, he rechecked this child with live smallpox, inoculating his arm, and he did not develop smallpox. He repeated it in 12 more cases, found that it was protective in those cases, and wrote it up in the medical literature, and that was the beginning of use of vaccines in modern era. It was actually interesting before this, even up to 200 years before, they used to, in some countries, try to protect from smallpox by people taking fluid from smallpox pustules and scratching the skin and putting it on the surface. They had done that in China and also in Africa and Sudan. And some of that information had gotten over to Constantinople, and back in the, before this, in the 1700s, they had started using that technique. But this was much better because nobody died from this. It was a safer vaccine. Not very purified, but safer. And there was actually quite a pushback in Great Britain in the early 1800s against this idea because it was felt that vaccines were unsanitary or maybe unchristian. Unsanitary you could understand, certainly, because taking some pus and scratching somebody's skin and putting it on top doesn't sound on the face of it like it'd be a great idea. But it was effective, and actually the Great Britain passed in 1853 a vaccination act which made it mandatory to vaccinate all infants for smallpox up to age 3 months, and eventually they extended to age 14 by 1867. In the United States, in the mid-1800s, there was also an anti-vaccine movement that culminated in 1902 in Cambridge, where a patient named Hemming Jackson refused the smallpox vaccine. The court told him, you have to get it done, it's the law. He appealed it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, who in 1905 ruled that states could, in fact, enact legislation that made it compulsory to get immunized for smallpox. And that's kind of the basis for some of the vaccine law that's come out since then. In other words, the concept emerged that it may be against your personal wishes to have this vaccine, but for the sake of our society, you need to get vaccinated because other people are going to suffer if you decide, I'm not getting the vaccine, and then you get smallpox and infect other people. So skipping now up into the 1900s in modern time, there's been a couple other waves of controversy that have come through and have played out more quickly these days because of the media and now internet too. In the 1970s, there was quite a large controversy, then again had originated in London, about whether DPT vaccines, DPT standing for diphtheria, pertussis, which is whooping cough, and T is for tetanus, whether it could have some neurologic consequences from the vaccine. Somebody had alleged that, and they actually had set up an independent commission to study it, which showed, no, that wasn't the case. The vaccines were safe. In the United States, though, it generated some secondary media attention to the point that there were multiple lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers by people who alleged that they had they or their children had sustained harm because of the vaccine, the DPT. And so because of this litigation, which, as you know, in the United States, anybody can sue anybody about anything, that there were, the litigation itself was very costly to vaccine manufacturers to defend. And so eventually they were concerned, as vaccine manufacturers started saying, okay, we're not going to manufacture vaccines anymore, they got down to just several vaccine manufacturers and said, we've got to do something about this. And what they did was pass in 1986 the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which said, we will, as a government, take over this problem, and we will ensure in no-fault insurance way that if your child has or you have something adverse happen because of a vaccine, you will report it to your physician. Your physician will report it to the federal government, and they keep track of this on a national database, and then you will be eligible for compensation depending on what happened to you because of the vaccine. Because of this, the vaccines were able to be continue to be manufactured in a cost-effective way, and so they went on. In modern times, there have been some improvements and refinements in vaccines. For example, the DPT that I just talked about has been replaced by a more highly purified version. The pertussis part was purified to just a few proteins that were enough to give your body the message to get your immune system on board to become immune to pertussis. And in 1997, they changed from the oral polio vaccine, which was the Sabin vaccine, to the inactivated polio vaccine, because there was a very, very low risk with the oral vaccine of somebody occasionally getting polio itself with this weakened version. And with the inactivated polio, which has nothing live in it, that eliminated that risk. So those changes were done. And even more, like into the 1990s now, there was a one issue that came up about a mercury-based preservative called thimerosal that was in vaccines, especially multiple dose vaccines where you have to, you know, draw from the vaccine vial to select another dose to give. Someone was alleging that that might cause problems in people. And even though there was no scientific proof that that was the case, because it was such a minuscule amount of preservative, they removed it from all vaccines in 1999, except for some multi-dose influenza vaccines. So that kind of faded into the background. The next controversy that came up in late 1990s, was a paper published by a research physician in Great Britain named Andrew Wakefield in the British Medical Journal called Lancet, that he was alleging there was some connection between the MMR, which stands for measles, mumps, and rubella, which comes as a combined vaccine, causing some inflammation in the lining of the bowel and somehow being associated with increased risk for autism. As this created quite a stir and increase in public fear about immunizations, because as you know, the incidence of autism in our population has been kind of gradually increasing over the last 40 or 50 years, and we really don't know why exactly. So it's natural that people think, well, maybe this is related. They looked at it in a number of studies, including the ones by the Institute of Medicine, or the IOM, and also studies in Denmark and other countries besides the United States, which discredited and said, no, there is no connection between MMR and autism. And actually, subsequently in 2010, the Lancet article was retracted, and the person who did the research was found that he had manipulated some of the data, and he was barred from medical practice. So that was pretty totally discredited. Most recently, there have been a few books written by people saying they're concerned about, with all the multiple vaccines that are out now, that it might be too much of a load on a child's immune system to be vaccinated with several vaccines in a visit. They had advocated this alternative vaccine schedule where you would just get one, and then you would come back a couple of days later or a couple weeks later and get another one, and it would stretch it out over a longer time period. There is no evidence to support this theory at all. Actually, someone has pointed out that the old DPT vaccine, which is, again, the diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine, this one right here, had about 3,000 proteins involved with that vaccine. The new one has about 5. So if it were actually problematic, we would have known it when we used the old vaccine, even before we used the new one. And these are highly purified vaccines. So this also has been discredited, and the risk of doing this alternative schedule where you string out the vaccines over a longer time period is you're obviously still at risk for getting the diseases while you're waiting to get the next dose if it's taking you a longer time to get them done. And finally, most recently, because of this fact, like in society, if too many people refuse to get vaccines, then it's kind of like a pinball situation where if you haven't been vaccinated and you get sick with a vaccine-preventable disease, and there's enough people in society who also haven't been vaccinated, there's a better chance you're going to run into one of them, they'll contract the disease, and they can spread it to other people who have not been adequately vaccinated. This happened most recently in California, where in 2015, there was a case of measles that came to Disneyland and caused other people to become infected who worked there and then people who visited there. And they had quite a number of cases of measles in a little outbreak in California, which also spread to some other areas. They found that when the Department of Public Health, did the studies, they found that the personal exemption rates, in other words, people saying, I don't want to get the vaccine just because I don't believe in vaccines, and that had increased to the point that it had doubled between 2007 and 2015, the number of people that had claimed an exemption and didn't want their child vaccinated. Therefore, about 1/4 of the schools did not have a statistically significant enough number of people who were well vaccinated to prevent spread of disease. So they were at risk. And therefore, they passed a law called the, it's a public law, 277, which was signed into law just in June, eliminating personal exemptions for vaccines. In other words, your child in California needs to be immunized unless you have a medical reason why they can't be vaccinated, to try to make sure that enough people still get vaccinated in order to make this effective still. So in the end, as I said here, I think this decision about vaccines, like all decisions in life, is based on getting some careful information, talking to people, and checking sites that are reputable sites, and making a decision carefully based on that. Because in reality, like all life events, it's an analysis of risk and benefit. There's no perfect vaccine. There's no risk-free days in life. I mean, I think I saw 100 people a year in the United States are killed by lightning strikes, but nobody doesn't go out when it's raining. So realizing the vaccines can cause some side effects, including certainly soreness at the injection site, muscle soreness, fever, irritability in infants, sometimes high fevers, and occasionally high enough fevers that they can have a seizure with it as an infant. Those are rare events. Other things like soreness and fever are more common events, maybe 15% or 20% sometimes, and some vaccines only 5%, but they're over in a day or two. And the benefit is that you're protected against some of the very serious life-threatening illnesses that used to take the life of children in the past. So even knowing that no vaccine is 100% effective, and even knowing there are some side effects to all vaccines. There's no denying the fact that vaccines have made a tremendous impact in the health and well-being and survival of children. As you can see, this is a busy slide, but if you look at some of the numbers, like diphtheria has been eliminated. Haemophilus influenza, which is a bacteria that used to cause meningitis and epiglottitis and serious blood infections, back when I was first in practice, now there's only maybe 30 or 40 cases a year instead of 20,000. Hepatitis has been affected, measles, mumps, rubella. Whooping cough has gone down, but only about 14%. There's still 14% as many as used to be, and that's because it's still not a perfect vaccine, but it's as good as we have for now. So a lot of children have survived to be young adults and adults because of vaccines, and it's just been a wonderful thing for health.
Thank you for listening to Cleveland Clinic Health Talk Podcasts. For more information, please visit our website at clevelandclinic.org/health.